Eku Iluna, please rise. Auhea oko eko ka aha. Ina he kuleana imua o kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki eke hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nao e mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 14-1135, BCI Coca-Cola Bottling Company v. Murakami, arguing for the petitioner, Ronald Fujiwara, arguing for respondent Murakami, Adam Rosenberg, arguing for respondent BCI Coca-Cola, Anna Alento-Sneed. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning and aloha, everyone. The court is honored to be here today in Lihue at Kauai Community College as part of our Courts in the Community program. Counselor, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Rosenberg and Ms. Alento-Steen, you as well. All right, we'll begin with Mr. Fujiwara. We'll go for 10 minutes. Give you a warning at 10 minutes because you have a total of 15 and you've asked to reserve 5 for rebuttal. We'll do the same with Mr. Rosenberg and then Ms. Alento-Steen. You have 30 minutes. We'll give you a 5-minute warning. Please proceed.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. We first thank the court for considering this case and for the hearing today, which is about 10 years ago when Tammy Yasui was injured while working with her employer. Thereafter, she filed a workers' compensation claim, which was deemed compensable under Chapter 386 of the Hawaii Revised Statute. As a result, she was off duty, unable to work, being temporarily totally disabled, as certified by her doctor, who treated her for some months, then finally released her to return to work. Full duty without restrictions. But when Ms. Yasui told her employer that she was returning to work, she was told that the position was filled by a permanent replacement. So the employer refused to return Ms. Yasui to the position she had before she went out on workers' compensation. Which raises the question, can the employer do that? Was it legal for the employer to refuse Ms. Yasui to return to work because the position was filled? To answer that question, we need to consider the law that was intended to protect workers, employees like Ms. Yasui, who were injured on the job as a result of a work injury. To answer that question, we look specifically to the statute that relates to this situation. And that statute is 386-32A2, which provides in pertinent parts relevant here this morning as follows. It shall be unlawful for any employer to discriminate against any of the employer's employees solely because the employee has suffered a work injury which arose out of and in the course of the employee's employment with the employer, which is compensable under Chapter 386, unless the employee is no longer capable of performing the employee's work as a result of the injury.
Mr. Fujiwara, if I could ask you, what is the extent of the employer's duty? In other words, how long was the employer required to hold this position for Ms. Josui?
That question, Your Honor, is to be answered under Chapter 386, HRS. It's a determination made by the Disability Compensation Division of the Department. Beginning with, first and foremost, a medical decision. A doctor has to certify that the claimant in that instance, or the patient as may be, is able to resume work. And there are ways and means for that determination to be made.
What if that process takes years? Is there any outer limit on how long the employer has to wait until a determination is made as to when the employee could return to work?
There is no definite time period, Your Honor. It's a matter for the employer, or more particularly, its insurance carrier, to do something about it. There are ways and means, there are rules and regulations that touch upon this issue. And as a matter of fact, it's a quite common procedure on the part of employer and or its insurance carrier to get to that point.
What are you suggesting that Coca-Cola should have done in this particular instance?
What Coca-Cola should have done is return Josui to the position she held before she was injured on the job.
If the position was such that they deemed it necessary to continue their business operations, what should they have done until she returned?
The statute is quite clear, Your Honor. As I mentioned, the determination of when and if an employee is able to return to work is a medical call under Chapter 386, Workers' Comp.
Could I enter? I'm sorry, Mr. Fujiwara, while you're on that subject, would you mind explaining a bit further how you analyze the ICA's determination? And correct me if I'm not explaining this correctly, but it seems that the analysis suggested that it's not really necessary to make a determination as to the continuation of the disability if it turns out that the business is experiencing a hardship. And the ICA used a couple of terms, business hardship and business necessity. But is that your reading of the opinion, that the ICA determined at a certain point the employer can act regardless of the condition of the employee and the employee's eligibility to return as long as they're having some business difficulty?
Yes, Justice Wilson, that is exactly my understanding of the reading of the ICA opinion. The opinion states that the business hardship, whatever you may wish to call it, is appropriate for the employer to use as a basis of refusing to return Ms. Josui to her job. However, the statute, the portion of the statute they were ignoring, overlooked perhaps, is that portion of the statute that says, unless the employee is no longer capable of performing the employees were. Now, that the question becomes, was Jusui no longer capable of performing her work, specifically during the time period of April 2010? That appears to be the position of the employer, and of course, the ICA seems to be agreeing with it. However, the question is, was Ms. Jusui no longer capable of performing her duties, work duties? No. The question is no. She was on workers' compensation,
but
unable
Coca-Cola,
to work.
Okay, but Coca-Cola is going to argue something different. Coca-Cola is arguing that their reasons were not solely because of the injury. They're going to say it's based on the hardship that the company was suffering. What's your response to that?
However, the employer used that replacement as their reason for saying, sorry, position filled. Now, they have made a connection between the two events, if I may call it that. There's a nexus here, Your Honor. The analogy I like to use is the refusal to return to work by the employer because the position was filled is to be viewed this way. The refusal to return to work is the fruit of the poisonous tree. That poisonous tree being the illegal, illegitimate, not in accordance with the statute about no longer being capable of performing.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Fujiwara. The workers' compensation chapter 386 appears to have provisions, HRS, I think 386.31, that talks about permanent partial disability and permanent total disability. It appears that there may be situations in which a permanent partial or a permanent total disability would constitute a finding of an inability to return to that position. Was there any such determination in Ms. Josue's case?
No.
She was on temporary total disability, but if there are cases after a while, a permanent decision is made. And what triggers, a referral for a finding of permanent partial or total disability? What triggers that? Is there something that causes that to happen in the work comp scheme?
Yes, there is, Madam Justice. As I mentioned, first and foremost, it's a medical decision. A doctor has to certify first that the claimant, the employee, the worker, is able to resume work. The statutes under 386 make that clear.
So, and the doctor has to say the employee cannot go back to that job.
Exactly. Then it becomes a permanent state.
And then we get to 378, too.
Right.
But, Mr. Fujiwara, let's assume that the proposition that you're suggesting, that there has to be a medical determination before a decision can be made as to whether the discharge was solely as a result of the disability. And let's assume that that isn't a requirement. I think that the position that's being taken by the employer is that if there is a reason other than the disability of the employee for the termination, then it can't be said that the termination is solely, right, because of the disability. And in this case, there seems to have been a disagreement, obviously, between the administrative agency and the courts about that determination, whether there was sufficient evidence that there was, I guess, a business necessity. So could you address that proposition? What evidence, and was it sufficient evidence to actually find that there was a business necessity?
There may have been a business necessity, But the question becomes, did the employer have the right to hire a permanent replacement?
So would you...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm following you. You're saying that there is a question about whether there is a need to have permanent employee, but are you referencing that with respect to whether it could be said that there was a business necessity? In other words, it wasn't really a business necessity because it wasn't necessary to put somebody there permanently? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah. The question of the business necessity, the business harm that they were supposedly suffering at that time, is not the issue here. It's not the key material fact. The key material fact is that they refused to return Mr. Sui to her work position because there was somebody already there. It was filled. That's what she was told. And it turned out the filling was on a permanent basis. That's the key. And to keep, please keep in mind.
Isn't that the, that may be what precipitates the discrimination. But are all discriminations precluded under the statute?
There is no discrimination at that point in time in April. There's no adverse action. You got to have it as the ICA said.
I didn't refer to April. I'm talking about when they didn't reinstate her.
Right.
That wasn't in April.
That's in September.
That was right. September. Yeah.
So, no, but what I'm asking you is that the fact that there, I think, and there may be disagreement, but it would seem to me that the record's clear that there is a discrimination that occurred in this case. But that's only the first question. That's only the first step. Once you determine that there's been discrimination, then you have to look at and determine whether it was solely because of the work injury or not.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Now, Mr. Fujiwara, you're at the end of your time, so if you would respond to Justice Pollack, and then we'll move on to Mr. Rosenberg.
We contend that the solely because portion of the statute that you are looking at relates back to the nexus that the employer relied upon. You can't have your job back because it's the fruit of the poisonous tree, that poisonous tree being the illegal, unreasonable replacement. It is not in accordance with the statute that is intended to protect the injured worker. 378.32A2 makes it clear. It may be lawful to do that if the employee is no longer, absolutely no longer, forever, unable to perform her duties at work. We're not there.
Very well, Mr. Fujiwara. Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Rosenberg now.
Please, the court. Deputy Attorney General.
You might want to speak up just a bit so we can be sure.
Bring your microphone.
Or bring the mic up.
Oh. Nice job.
Sorry about that. Try that. See how that works.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Deputy Attorney General Adam Rosenberg, appearing on behalf of the Director of Labor and Industrial Relations and the Department of Labor and Industrial Relations, State of Hawaii, to whom I will collectively refer as the DLIR. Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, Ms. Josui, the petitioner in this case, suffered an injury while working for her employer, Coca-Cola, the respondent in this case, and when she recovered from her injury, Coke refused and failed to return her to her pre-work injury position and failed to offer her a position that was not a downgrade, not a reassignment to other duties at a lower rate of pay, or not discriminatory in the conditions or terms of employment as required by HRS Section 378.32.
Absent a permanent total or partial disability finding, How long does an employer have to wait?
There is no strict time frame, Your Honor. However, there is a process for this type of situation in which an employer wishes an employee were no longer capable of performing his or her duties as a result of a work injury. Employers may work to have an employee deemed permanently disabled in the workers' compensation
case. I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble
hearing
you, and you can slow down just a little bit, Mr. Rosenberg. Thank you.
Apologize. Thank you. There is a process for this type of situation in which an employer wishes an employee were no longer capable of performing his or her duties as a result of a work injury. Employers may work to have an employee deemed permanently disabled in the workers' compensation case. Employers can hire a doctor to opine on the issue of whether the employee is no longer capable. Employers can ask their doctors to opine on whether they're no longer capable. The DLIR can make determinations, and aggrieved parties can appeal.
And so no request was made by the employer in this case, correct, to have Ms. Josue deemed permanently disabled?
That's correct.
But, okay, so is it the department's position that without such a determination, the employer can never discriminate against an employee based on 378-2A?
Thank you, Your Honor. The legislature actually took employers' interest into account when enacting HRS Section 378-32A2. The legislature specifically addressed the excuse of business necessity, concerns, or hardship when it exempted employers with fewer than three employees, and it burdened employees with the stringent standard of solely because instead of the lesser standard of because. And the legislature has not chosen to account for business hardship.
Can you slow down a little bit? I'm really having problems understanding you.
Sorry about that. The legislature has exempted employers with fewer than three employees, and it burdened employees with the very stringent standard of solely because instead of the lesser standard of because.
And isn't that very significant in this case? Because the employer says it wasn't solely because of her injury, it was also because of a legitimate business necessity. So the statute doesn't apply to them. That's their position. Why isn't that, why would you disagree with that position, since the language solely because appears to be somewhat unique in this particular provision, and you don't see it elsewhere in the statute?
Thank you, Your Honor. The DLIR found that the law affords injured workers more protection than Koch afforded Ms. Josue. A need to fill the particular position vacated by an injured employee cannot be a lawful, legitimate, and non-discriminatory excuse for suspending, discharging, or discriminating against an employee who has recovered from a work injury. That is exactly what the law is intended to prevent.
So your DLIR's position is that until there is a permanent finding of disability, you can only have a temporary replacement, and then the employee has to be returned to the position?
That's correct, Your Honor. Koch's business necessity is solely related to Ms. Josue's work injury.
What if the employer can't find a temporary replacement because someone doesn't want to take the job on that very uncertain basis? What happens then?
Thank you, Your Honor. As I noted, they could attempt to have the employee deemed to be permanently disabled through the DLIR's Chapter 386 process.
What if the person isn't permanently disabled? I guess that's the question. What is the employer supposed to do in that instance when it's a skilled position and they can't fill it? In this particular instance, they had other workers filling in for quite a long time.
Well, Your Honor,
what is the employer supposed to do under that circumstance?
I'll just note first that the legislature has not chosen to account for business hardship beyond what I mentioned earlier, as the federal government has in the Family and Medical Leave Act, which includes provisions for key employees and substantial and grievous economic injury. And also the American with Disabilities Act has an even more stringent undue hardship test. I'm sorry.
So you're saying that the Hawaii legislature could have adopted such provisions and has not done so?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, so let's say that this temporary condition lasts for 5 years. The company closes down. That would not trigger 378-2, right?
I believe that's correct. I believe if there were no company any longer, I don't think the employee would have a cause of action against that company, obviously.
Would they have to do it if the company was in bankruptcy?
If the company were still operating and paying employees, it's possible that the department could find that employee is entitled to reinstatement, back pay, or both.
What happens if you have a situation where was the cutoff three employees? What did you say the cutoff was?
Fewer than three. The statute says less than.
What happens if that it's a four or five employee company and having that one person out was so significant that it, you know, the person had special skills, that's what, you know, you can't get a temporary replacement, it causes the company to go under. Is that something that the legislature, I mean, in order to protect an employee in some sense, because the employee is getting disability payment, the company goes underwater? Is that logical?
Your Honor, the one option would be the company could fill the employee's position, and when the employee becomes capable of performing her duties again, offer her an alternative position that is not a downgrade, reassignment to other duties at a lower rate of pay, or not discriminatory in the conditions or terms of employment. Alternatively, occasionally, if not frequently, employers and employees make settlement agreements through the workers' compensation case, and sometimes part of the settlement agreement is that the employee will not return to his or her pre-work injury position.
So if I'm clear with your position, Mr. Rosenberg, as a matter of law, you define solely in 378-32 to mean that an employee is being discharged solely because of work injury.
That's correct.
When the discharge takes place before a medical determination has been made, period, as a matter of law.
That's right.
And no matter what the circumstances are with the underlying business, that legal proposition remains.
Well, we have two cases on the books, Your Honor. One was the O'Connell versus Isocor case, which had a very similar workers' compensation discrimination provision. And in that case, the employer began the process of terminating the employment of the injured employee as part of a company-wide reduction in force nearly 2 weeks prior to the employee's injury. And we also have the Fergerstrom case, in which termination of the employee did not violate Section 378.
You think Fergerstrom is good law? You don't take issue with Fergerstrom?
To my knowledge, it has not been overruled.
But that wasn't
but
the question.
That's a federal district court case. We're not bound by that, right?
And in Fergerstrom, didn't the court actually determine that despite the fact that there hadn't been there actually had been a medical determination, Ferguson. I guess you're right. There was a medical determination there, wasn't there?
Actually, in that case, as for your question first, Your Honor, it did deal with 378-32. I'll just note that. And then in that case, there was an administrative discharge policy or a no-fault discharge policy in which all employees who were absent from work for a specific period of time were discharged regardless of the reason. Therefore, there was no option for the employer to discriminate because all employees were treated the same.
But
that was not the case in this case.
But so you're saying that this case, which says that despite our statutes, this case, which says that if a company has a policy that after 90 days you're gone, no matter what kind of injury you had, we should uphold that. What would preclude a company from having a policy that if you're injured for 5 days, you're automatically terminated?
I'm not suggesting that you need to follow that. I'm just relaying to you the history as it is currently on the books as far as what has been decided about this issue.
But help me with the interpretation of Fergerstrom, because it seems that the court assumed that the employee was disabled. Said the plaintiff gave data point ample reason to believe he was totally disabled from the work. So it seemed from a factual point of view, the assumption was that the employee was disabled, which I would think would be a significant factual difference between that case and this case where there hasn't been such a determination, correct?
I believe Mr. Fergerstrom did regain capability. I'm not certain, but I believe that he did it, but not at the 90-day period. And again, there was a distinction between Koch's policy and the data point policy. Koch's policy has a discretionary policy. They say you are generally entitled to getting your position back and that they may, if you don't return within the 12 months for a disability leave of absence, you may be terminated.
But it sounds like you're conceding that the employer can define disability simply by having an administrative disability policy that says after a certain number of days. I mean, let's assume the employer said if the employee can't work for 20 days, then that employee is disabled. You would accept that proposition?
I'm not saying I would accept it. I'm just relaying again what courts have decided, and I'll also note that it wasn't necessarily disabled.
Thank you for that clarification, because it sounds like it's unclear whether you believe that Fergusstrom stands for the proposition that an administrative policy of the employer can define disability.
I apologize, Your Honor. In that policy, I don't think it was actually disability, because if an employee missed the 90 days for whatever reason, regardless of whether they were injured or not, in that situation, the employee was terminated.
Right, but in that case, it involved disability, right? That was the determination of disability.
Correct.
So in effect, the administrative policy determined disability.
Correct. However, again, if Mr. Fergusstrom had gone on vacation for 90 days, he would have been terminated the exact same.
I'm still confused. Are you backing Fergusstrom? Are you supporting the holding in Fergusstrom? Is that DLIR's position?
No, Your Honor, we have not faced that circumstance.
Okay.
Mr. Rosenberg, you're into your rebuttal time. Do you have anything further for the court at this time, or do you wish to retain that time for later?
I'd appreciate to retain it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well, thank you. Then we'll hear from Ms. Alento-Steed at this time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Anna Alento-Steed for BCI Coca-Cola. This case is actually one of first impression. It involves the interpretation of Section 378.32, which prohibits employers from suspending, discharging, or discriminating against employees solely because they've suffered a work injury compensable under the state workers' compensation statute. The issue here is how to interpret discrimination solely because someone has suffered a workers' comp injury, and we haven't had a case like this before the court. The material facts of the case are not in dispute. The case actually hinges on statutory construction, and the way the ICA tried to break it down for everybody is the definition of discrimination, and then also what does the phrase solely because mean. The parties all acknowledge, okay, that the statute doesn't define these terms, there are no regulations that interpret the statute, there are no previous court cases that interpret these terms. Accordingly, the Department of Labor, DLIR, at the director's level, the Circuit Court, and the ICA have each been asked to interpret the law. Now the parties are asking this court to review the case de novo and render a final decision. This court has set guidelines for statutory construction in In Re water use permit applications and in Richardson versus City and County of Honolulu, which the ICA and the Circuit Court attempted to apply or applied when they rendered their decisions. The ICA focused on the clause solely because the employee has suffered a work injury and ruled that, you know, there was no violation of 378.32 because BCI's decision was based on operational difficulties.
Could I interrupt you for a moment,
sure.
Ms. Alento-Steed, because I know you're focusing on this idea of de novo review. I wanted your help in terms of the way we should look at the determination made by the administrative agency, because
yes. A
decision, and I think that the determination of the ICA was that the decision below, that is the decision with the administrative agency as to whether this was the sole cause for the discharge, was clearly erroneous.
Yes.
So they didn't apply de novo standard. So would you agree with that, that for us it's important to consider it from a clearly erroneous point of view? In other words, whether it was clearly erroneous, an abuse of discretion for the hearing officer to find based on the evidence that this was the sole reason for the discharge?
Your Honor, this is the third time the case has been appealed. When the case was first presented to the circuit court, BCI was the moving party in the appeal, and we used Section 91-14 and went through all of the administrative tests to show, among other things, arbitrary and capricious decision, wasn't supported by the evidence, clearly erroneous in terms of the interpretation of the law.
Why wasn't it? How is it clearly erroneous if the only testimony about being a hardship is that some of the other supervisors were coming in 2 hours early?
Because there was no contrary testimony from Ms. Josue at the hearing to show that this was untrue or anything uncontested.
Yeah, but how does it show the fact that people coming in 2 hours early, they may have been getting paid for it, they may have liked it, things. I mean, how does that show a need? There has to be some operational impairment or some business need. You would agree with that, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and it wasn't 2 hours. There were two supervisors who had to split a third supervisor's job, so they did 1.5 jobs for 10 months.
But does that on its face, I mean, they could have been paid for it. There's nothing in the record, the factual record, saying that they were disgruntled, it was causing ill effect. They weren't getting paid. There's nothing like that. It just says that after a certain amount of period, the company decided to bring in somebody else.
It is in the record, Your Honor. You would have to go all the way back to the DLIR hearings and the testimony that was introduced by the human resources and the company's witnesses, and this would have been 10 years ago.
I have that testimony in front of me. Mm-hmm. Counsel.
So and what are you referring to specifically?
It is in the...
And what does it say? What is the testimony that you're saying that demonstrates that it's a hardship?
It was in the ROA at 353, 491, and on. Basically, what it was is that BCI couldn't sustain the burden of having two supervisors do the job of what was three, and that it was disrupting the workforce, and that's why they made the decision to fill the position. There was no contrary testimony from Ms. Josue or her counsel to show that this was not true.
Does the record reflect whether or not Coca-Cola BCI tried to find a temporary replacement?
They left the position open and then filled it right at the 10-month mark around, I think,
right.
In the testimony.
Right, and your policy actually was to wait 12 months, right? But
right.
In any event, that's not why we're here.
Right.
Basically, I hear you saying that there was nothing in the record to show that BCI actually tried to have a temporary person fill that position. In other words, in many companies, and especially in government, it's very routine for when someone is out for a long period of time, for there to be someone that is below to go up on a temporary assignment. And a lot of times people are happy to do that because they get paid more, at least temporarily. And then they're in training for that position. If that person doesn't come back, then they might be able to get the full-time position. Or if another opening comes up, they might be able to get it. So that was not attempted here.
BCI was fortunate because the person who held the supervisor position before Ms. Josue actually returned to Hawaii and inquired, and so he got his old job back. The record citation at that is in our brief to the circuit court.
But there's nothing to indicate that it was offered to him temporarily.
No, it was, they filled the position because at the time, and this is also in the record, no one knew whether or not she was ever going to come back.
They didn't ask.
They did inquire and try to reach out to her. She did not respond. That is also in the record. What ended up happening...
Did they contact the doctor?
Your Honor, what happens in the workers' compensation system, that it is the employer cannot contact the doctor, that would be a violation of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, federal HIPAA law. What happens is the entity that does the contact is the workers' comp insurance carrier, and specifically their claims adjuster. That is the person that deals on the workers' compensation side with the employee. The employer simply waits to find out what happened. I will tell you that when they reached out to find out with Ms. Josue whether or not she was going to return to work, they heard nothing, but then the workers' comp adjuster notified Coca-Cola that she had self-referred into vocational rehabilitation. The vocational rehabilitation system is part of the workers' compensation statute. When an employee, per their doctor, has reached stability, they're not going to get better, they're not going to get worse, then the question becomes, can they replace them, put them back into the workforce? In this situation, the vocational rehabilitation carrier started her at stage two. Stage two is to find a position other than your original position that you might be capable of performing.
Don't you have to be determined to be capable to not be on TTD anymore in order to go into voc rehab?
What happens?
Is that true?
It depends, Your Honor. People who are on voc rehab actually receive temporary total disability payments. In fact, Ms. Josue continued to receive TTD payments for the entire length of her vocational rehabilitation period. That is also in the record.
How does someone qualify for voc rehab benefits?
Voc rehab is basically a program where they try to ease...
I know what it is. I'm asking how they qualify for it.
You can actually, at the time that she was in the system, the state had revised the voc rehab process so that employees could self-refer, which they did, and then the state pays for the voc rehab counselor.
So there's no determination that she can't return to her original position?
No, they
so
just...
So you had no indication, just because she was in voc rehab, that she was never going to return to the original
position?
The
only presumption they could have was that she wanted to return to a job other than hers.
Ms. Alantos-Need, isn't Justice Nakayama's point that... And I think you alluded to it earlier, there's no factual dispute that this employee could have come back to work. At the time that a permanent replacement was hired for her, there hadn't been a determination that she was unable to work. So that's clear. So
yeah.
I understood what you were trying to say was that at a certain point, even though the employee may be able to come back, even though the employee hasn't been determined to be unable to work, the employer has to move forward.
Yes.
The employer then can make a determination based on business necessity, and therefore the discharge or the decision not to retain the employee in the same position is being made for a reason that's not solely the injury, right?
Yes.
So getting back to the idea of the record here, you, I think, have helped us with the idea that it's important to look at the record, go back to the record. And that concept is certainly endorsed by the idea of applying a clearly erroneous standard. So here you have a hearing officer who sees that the employee has not been determined unable to return to work, gets the information from the employer that the supervisors have to split the time. At a certain point, I think the hearing officer asked, what was your decision-making process in terms of deciding that you're going to have a permanent employee? And the hearing officer was told, well, that's confidential. You recall that point. So then the hearing officer makes a decision and says, well, it doesn't seem to me that it's really that much of a business hardship. And now, unless I misperceive it, we are in a position in which we're being asked to consider the ICA's analysis of the facts, an analysis of the facts that would suggest that the hearing officer was clearly erroneous. So why wouldn't there be a factual basis if we give deference to the hearing officer for the determination that under these facts there just wasn't enough of a business necessity? Why should we substitute our judgment?
Because the burden is on the plaintiff if they're going to argue discrimination to show that it was discrimination.
Well, let's stop there. The statute says that you would agree that there was an act of discrimination here. Yes or no?
There was a decision. To the extent the decision picks one versus the other, in the generic dictionary sense, yes, they picked filling the position.
Okay, and so in order to justify that this discrimination act, you have to show a business necessity, which the business has the facts to demonstrate it, and the business has the facts, if there are such facts, to show why a temporary replacement could not be utilized.
The term business necessity comes from Chapter 370(2), the employment decision, where you have a facially neutral policy that has a disparate impact. That's for discrimination under the other forms of discrimination. This, as the ICA noted, is its special type of discrimination. It is much more restricted in the ability of the plaintiffs to prove.
Can you maybe move the mic just a bit away? Let's try.
I'm louder.
As long as everyone can
hear.
Hear
me? Yeah. This statute is very different from the provisions in 378-2, as the ICA noted. The language solely become cause of only exists in 378-32. It doesn't exist under 378-2. So that's a very distinct difference.
You know, one difference one might conclude is that when we take the discrimination that you look under the Shop McDonald type of formulation.
Yes.
There you're looking to try to determine whether or not discrimination actually occurred. Here it's something really different.
Yes.
Here we start with the premise, actually, that this is someone who has been injured performing their job. And it has to arise out of their and be in the course of their employment. So this is somebody who's been dutifully doing their job. They've been injured. And what's uncontested is that they're not restored when they're back to their job. So the discrimination has already occurred here. So it only becomes okay under the statute if a legitimate reason is demonstrated by the employer for their actions.
And that's what the approach that the ICA and the circuit court took. But I would want to point out one thing, because we've been talking around the issue, and the crux of the issue has to do with Ms. Josue's and the DLIR's contention that everyone should defer to the agency on its interpretation of the definition of discrimination. The DLIR's definition of discrimination, and also Ms. Josue's, is based on two faulty assumptions. One, that employers must give employees who suffer a work injury a leave of absence for as long as they are on workers' compensation. Indeed, Mr. Fujiwara talked about the workers' compensation statute as being the evidence of that. You can look through the entire workers' compensation statute and you will find no mention of the word leave of absence.
There is no finding that is the reason, either by the board or the hearing officer. Their findings are dependent upon the fact that you folks did not show that a temporary replacement could not have been utilized. And there's nothing in the record. In fact, when you guys were asked that specifically, you said, I'm from page 258, I think, of that. It says, so who requested to fill that position of Ms. Josue? It was the department manager, and who was that? His name is Simon Mitsutomo. So did that request come to you or through someone else, or how does it work? It came to me, it came to you, and you made that decision. Yeah, it's time to go ahead, we can fill the position. Yes, and that's an internal process that I follow to get its approval. And then what does it involve? Oh, I'm not sure I can discuss that. I think it's confidential. It's only privilege. So there's nothing showing why a temporary replacement could not have been hired at that point in time.
But the issue is whether or not there's any obligation, legal obligation, which is the second false assumption made by the department and the appellant, that the statute requires implicitly, it's not even explicitly there, that the employer only hire temporary employees who must be fired or vacate the position the minute the first employee decides they want to come back to work.
But there's actually some case law on how business necessity is defined in terms of these discrimination type cases, right?
Business.
And the first requirement is that the employer needs to demonstrate that there was a necessity to fill the position.
Right, and so what you get is testimony, the employer's burden.
Okay, so assume you meet that burden.
Okay.
You needed to fill the position, whether
right.
it's with a permanent or a temporary. But the second prong is that whether there are other ways for the employer to achieve its goals that do not result in discrimination. So therefore, under that prong, why wouldn't the issue of whether or not a temporary person was sought or could have been obtained, why isn't that relevant to that issue? And why would the DLIR's findings in that regard be clearly erroneous?
Because that requirement and proof is not something that's part of the work injury statute.
So under your theory, a person could go out for, say, 3 days and you show a need to do it, and there's no reason under your philosophy or the argument that you're presenting, even though you could easily get a replacement or temporary person for a few days, bingo, you could terminate.
In fact, Your Honors, what the department actually pointed out, and it's in the record, is that an employer is free to terminate a person on workers' comp as long as they're not able to return to work. In which case, then, you would...
How is that determined, though? Isn't that usually with a PPD?
No, actually,
PTD?
I think that's the conceptual problem. The workers' compensation statute and the work injury statute do not control termination or leaves. That is actually now the subject and controlled by a totally different body of law that was enacted in 1990 and then subsequently, and that is the Americans with Disabilities Act and the state chapter 378-2, when they added prohibitions against actions against the disabled.
But you're saying that under 378-2A does not prohibit an employer from terminating someone that's out on work comp.
What happens now, and that was the case in 2010, but not in 1981 when this provision of the work injury statute was put in place, is that leaves of absence, as Mr. Fujiwara and Mr. Rosenberg pointed out, there is a leave called the Family and Medical Leave. The Americans with Disabilities Act and the state counterpart also now have provisions on leave which must be granted to people who are covered and disabled. People on extended workers' compensation like Ms. Josue, the terms of their ability to get back to work and then to get what they call the interactive reasonable accommodation process is now controlled by the disability discrimination laws as well as the voc rehab system, which was amended shortly before Ms. Josue to give control over reinstatement from workers' comp back into the workplace.
Does it say that in the statute? Because that's
yes.
exactly what their argument is that the question, I asked the question, can this go on indefinitely? The answer is no. There's a process under the workers' compensation statute that the employer can utilize to determine if the employee is permanently disabled. I'm sure you remember that
yes.
question. What would your response be to the argument that, no, it's not indefinite. There's a process that can be followed. All the employer had to do was follow it.
The employer does not control, no longer controls the vocational rehabilitation process. The state amended that process shortly before Ms. Josue, I think it was either 2008 or 2009, so that the control over vocational rehabilitation was transferred to the State Department of Labor and Industrial Relations, which then appoints the VR counselors. So what you have and what you're struggling with is what employers euphemistically call the Bermuda Triangle, which is the convergence of workers' compensation, leave laws and the Americans with Disabilities Act, which all control situations as here, where you have people who are on long-term workers' compensation, and there's a question about whether or not they can be returned to work, and if so, in what capacity. And so what happens, and what happens with Coca-Cola, and you will see in the record, is that at the time, she did not fail to respond and was about to expire. She self-referred into vocational rehabilitation and was assigned a voc rehab counselor. At the same time, because her leave then expired, Coca-Cola tried to reach out to her to ask her what does she want
I'm
to do.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I know you're repeating the analysis that you provided before about how, in this case, maybe Coca-Cola had some reason to think she wasn't going to be able to come back to work. But I thought that there was a understanding in terms of the record that it's clear there was no determination that she was unable to return to work.
There was no determination in April that she was able to return to work.
Yeah, so in other words, with respect to 378-32, it cannot be said that the employee was no longer capable of performing work, and therefore the employer had an obligation to return the employee to the position unless there was a reason to terminate other than the disability.
The position, at the time that the position was filled, the record shows that no one knew, and neither did Ms. Josui, and this is
now you're reciting your version of the record,
no.
But I'm interested in the point of your analysis of the record. Are you coming to the conclusion that the employer can terminate an employee who, on the basis of disability, where the employee has not been determined to be unable to return to work? There's a circumstance where that can happen?
The employer now, today, versus in 2010 when this happened.
Well, let's try to stick with 2010 because I don't yet see an analysis that says that under 378-32, an employee can be terminated from a position if the employee is capable of return, if it has not been shown that the employee is not capable of returning to work.
If the
record shows that the employee could still return to work,
the employer
is obligated to provide that employee with a position, the same position.
Under the terms of the statute, the work injury statute does not, and the hearing officer and the director agreed, the work injury statute does not prohibit an employer from terminating an employee, whether that is currently on workers' compensation.
Well, that wasn't what I was discussing. I'm talking about a situation where you have a record that shows that the employee is in a position to come back to work eventually. In other words, there's no decision that's been made that would suggest that the employee is unable to return to work.
And I think the problem, Your Honor, is because the decision to fill the position was made back in April of 2010, when no one knew, neither the appellant nor BCI, that she would ever be able to return to work.
Okay.
You think 15 months later, then she decided to return, but there was no vacancy
at that
point.
It was 5 months after that.
Yeah.
So, you talk about the voc rehab.
Right.
Was there a voc rehab plan already in April of 2010?
I don't know when she received the voc rehab. We do know that.
And you talk about it was a step two, which is
right. You're
not going to go back to the same position, but you're going to try to find other
right. Jobs.
But the voc rehab statute, 386.25, seems to say that, it can change. You can still go back to change your plan to go back to the original position.
The voc rehab plan, again, is between the employee and their voc rehab counselor. who did not make contact with Coca-Cola until after the position had been filled.
But you just said earlier in your argument the reason that you hired somebody else was because you got the impression she was looking elsewhere.
No.
So now you can't say that, oh, we don't know what's going on, because you used the fact that she was using Voc Rehab services to justify hiring somebody else.
The decision that they needed to fill the position was made first. Subsequently to that, and I don't remember the exact date, they discovered she went into Voc Rehab. But the decision to fill the position...
Okay, so Voc Rehab has nothing to do with filling the position.
Only in terms...
So why did you...
No, only in terms of trying to find her, in terms of the discrimination, whether or not they were denying her or whether they were making efforts under state law as well as federal law to find her an alternative position.
You know, you talk about the ADA and the discrimination statutes. Those statutes apply whether or not it's a workers' compensation-related disability. So it seems to me that what we, when there is a general statute and a specific statute, you look at the specific statute. The specific statute really is 378.32. It seems to me that all we're doing here is construing 378.32.
But what we were in the hearing officer's decision, as which was affirmed by the director, they found it to be discriminatory that we were offering her positions which they termed downgraded and of less pay and benefits. That was part and parcel of what the department was looking at the time they made the decision. The reason these positions were given to her was because of the vocational rehabilitation system as well as the ADA requirement for interactive reasonable accommodation. So it wasn't because they were discriminating, it's because Coca-Cola had to comply with three totally different statutes.
Are you saying that Mr. Fujiwara was not being completely truthful when he said that she was allowed to return to work? She was at fully capable of returning to work
in September,
and so she was ready, willing, and able to return to her former job.
What happened is when she could not return to her work, she went back out on workers' compensation.
No, we're talking about when she came back to work. She was able to come back, and that is when you offered her lesser positions, right?
Because we were in the interactive process, and that's when she finally made contact.
But the doctor said she was fully able to return to
position.
So why would you then offer her a position below what she was getting before?
Because her position had been filled. There was no vacancy.
So it wasn't based on the fact that she that you had a perception that she wasn't able to do the job.
It was because the position was filled.
You know, 378.32.2a, you talk about these other laws, but that statute itself requires you to try to find her other employment, whether or not these other laws were subsequently enacted or not.
I understand, Your Honor, but one of the other conditions that the employers have to live under is under the Americans with Disabilities Act, there's a preemption clause that preempts any inconsistent federal or state statute. And so Coca-Cola being subject, and all employers in Hawaii being subject to all these laws.
I'm sorry, did you argue that in
yes,
your?
Yes, I did.
Okay, what chapter is that
it's
again?
It's in the circuit court, our brief to the circuit court.
Is it in the, your
There's
answering
no
brief?
And, pardon?
Is it your in your answering brief in the ICA?
Yes, we it's also in there as well. We pointed it out.
I'm going to allow Justice Pollack. Did you have another question? Or at this point, I'm going to give Mr. Fujiwara another minute or two for rebuttal. So I'll give you a minute or two as well to wrap up at this point, Ms. Alento Sneed.
I think.
I'm sorry. Before you wrap up, I think it'll just take a minute. Why did the employer terminate the employee in this case? Was it because there was a decision made that she wasn't able to come back to work? Is that the reason, more specifically, is that the reason why there was an employee put in her place in a permanent position? It was because she wasn't able to come back to work? Was that your determination?
She wasn't actually terminated, Your Honor, for purposes of this matter.
Well, let's approach it from the point of view of the decision to put somebody in her position permanently, which would mean she couldn't come back to work. Let's look at it that way. Okay. Right? That was the decision made, correct?
Right.
Okay. When that decision was made, was it because the employer determined that she was unable to return to work?
The employer did not know if she'd ever. She was gone. The decision was made because this was in April when they filled the position, is because of the operational hardship on the department. They needed to fill it.
I thought it was because they were lucky that somebody showed up in town who held the job before and they wanted to give them a full-time position.
No, you were asking whether or not they did a job search or for a new person. I said that the person who actually got the job was the former occupant of the position who happened to come back and ask for the job.
You know, you talk about attempting to contact her, but in your answering brief, you say that because she had exhausted her leave of absence under your policy in June of 2010, you twice attempted to contact her. This is after the position had already been filled.
Yes, because she was still on, quote, payroll. She hadn't been terminated. And the employer, after the position has been filled, has a legal obligation to go through the interactive process and also to comply with the voc rehab procedure.
But you indicated you tried to contact her before you filled the position, and I'm reading your brief, and it appears that there was no attempt to contact her until after the position had been filled.
No, they attempted to actually, let me find it for you. They did attempt to contact her before they got no response. Yep.
When was that?
I'm looking. It's cited actually in our brief to the circuit court. And because they did not get a response from her, and they had not heard from her or her doctors, it's around that area, about whether or not she could ever return to work.
All right, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
True.
So if you would like to wrap up and give us any final thoughts.
Yes, final thoughts,
Ms.
Alentis. I think one of the things that we also need to point out is the policy issues, which the ICA and the circuit court noted. There are significant policy issues here because the decision does create a conflict between DLIR divisions, what wage standards does in terms of work injury cases, what the Civil Rights Commission does, and following the EEOC with respect to interactive reasonable accommodation process, and then what the Disability Compensation Division does, which is a totally separate issue with respect to workers' comp and voc rehab. Employers, the reason you have amici briefs at every level of the case is because of the huge implications this case is going to have for employers. The DLIR's interpretation of 378.32 will wreak havoc on longstanding employment practices and how employers juggle all of these statutes, whether it was in 2010 and now 9 years later. In fact, I believe the department understands that because in response to the application for writ of cert, noted that they would take care of this problem by other means, which we presume means regulations or amendment of the statute. We live in a time, the statute you're looking at was created in 1981. Times have changed. We have huge problems now and lots of statutes that are very complex that employers have to deal with. And the law didn't stand still. The decision now will greatly impact everybody, both employers and employees. Because essentially, if you say that if a person who goes out on workers' comp can have dibs on the, his or her position, no matter how long they have been gone, it creates a have-not for the employee who is not fortunate enough to get injured and to come second to the position. That is something both employers and employees will not be able to deal with very easily, and it will disrupt everyone's operations.
Thank you. Mr. Fujiwara, I'll give you some brief rebuttal. If you keep it to a minute or two, if you would.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. This court is not concerned about policies. Policies belong before the legislature.
Oh, you try to speak into the mic, sir.
Policy questions belong before the legislature. We are dealing with a very specific statute here. It's intended to protect employees who get hurt on the job. An accident, an incident of no fault of their own. I'm struck by the statement of Ms. Alento Steve that somehow the insurance company is separate from the employer. No. They're one and the same people. The insurance company is an agent of the employer. During this supposed time that they tried to contact Mr. Sui before what they're claiming before the replacement, there was an insurance company, an adjuster, who was in contact with Mr. Sui. There was a VR counselor in contact with Mr. Sui. You go, she's on workers' compensation, people. That's her arena. That's what she must satisfy at this point in time. Just a little correction, I believe Justice McKenna touched upon it. Insofar as VR is concerned, vocational rehabilitation, yeah, you're right. They're talking about step two. Step one is going back to your old job, the job that you had before. And that can change at any time, as I believe Ms. Alentosnini is also referring to, or maybe it was you, Justice. It can change depending on the medical condition of the claimant, the employee. We're dealing with medical issues when we talk about disability. That comes first. That being the case, workers' compensation case here comes first and foremost. Whatever happened, happened because she was injured on the job. No ifs or buts about it. We need to start there. This is a very specific statute. You are correct. It's very unusual. I grant you that, but you review the legislative history, there was a reason for it. People who are on workers' comp were getting downgraded. They were being reassigned jobs below their pay rate. Something had to be done. And this particular amendment in 1981 was an attempt to solve that problem. Mr. Anderson talks about all these ADA vocations. We're dealing with a specific statute. If you don't like the statute, go to the legislature, see what you can do to change it. But that's what we're stuck with at this point. And that's what we're saying was violated. It was violated even with the replacement, as Justice Wilson pointed out. There was never, ever a finding of her being permanent, unable to return to work. She got better, thank goodness. That's what the workers' compensation law is all about. A worker gets hurt on the job through no fault of his. You're provided medical treatment. Get better, go back to work. That's the intent of the whole workers' compensation law. And this law, 378, is intended to protect the worker. That's the long and the short of it. Now, insofar as a solely because phrase, they have created a nexus. They used the replacement to refuse to give her a job. We didn't do it, they did it. And the nexus doesn't have to be, you know, at the same time. We're talking about a connection, a nexus, because. As I said, the refusal to return Ms. Chisui to her position she held is the fruit of the poisonous tree. And you are perfectly right. They never made an attempt at any tentative replacement. You're right, Justice Wilson. They had their own policy that they didn't even follow. They made the replacement before her disability time with their own policies was up. Easy solution, if we're looking for easy solutions. They could have waited a few more months, hired somebody temporarily for a few more weeks, actually. Then they could have fired her. Her leave period under their policy would have been over.
Mr. Fujiwara, anything, if you would, wrap up your remarks. We are running over, and I appreciate it. But
we got back to the good point.
Anything further at this time for the court?
No, thank you very much. That's all I can say for this opportunity.
Very well.
I've been waiting for this day for a long time, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Fujiwara.
8 years.
Please, I'd ask the, please, at this time, I'd ask that you not interrupt to just out of courtesy to the other participants. So please, if you would, just wait for Mr. Rosenberg, who is going to be coming up at this point.
Thank you again, Your Honors. Just have a few quick points to make. First, we'll note that the ICA mentioned a lack of finding of pretext in their memorandum opinion, and we'll just point out that in the cases that have the pretext analysis, McDonnell Douglas, Schaap, Adams versus CDM Media, that line of cases, the standard in those cases was because, while the standard in this case is solely because. We'll also note that the Fergerstrom and O'Connell cases were motions for summary judgment, but we'll note again that there was no McDonnell Douglas analysis in those cases. However, if that analysis does apply, the DLIR contends that Koch did not meet its burden of producing a lawful, legitimate, and non-discriminatory reason for discriminating against Ms. Chosui. And if the burden of production was deemed to have been met, there is evidence in the record that Koch's excuse of business necessity concerns or hardship was pretextual. As Justice Pollack pointed out, it is unclear that Koch actually needed to fill Ms. Chosui's position because it is unclear who determined that the operational hardship necessitated the permanent filling of her position. Both Coca-Cola representatives who testified in the administrative hearing denied initiating the action of filling Ms. Chosui's position or requesting that her position be filled. Additionally, I'll note that Ms. Alento-Sneed alluded to the definition of discrimination used by the Department of Labor and Industrial Relations. We'll note that the definition used by the department was the definition provided by the legislature in the legislative history when they noted that it is to be defined as a position that's not a downgrade, not a reassignment to other duties at a lower rate of pay, or not discriminatory in the conditions or terms of employment. Additionally, when Ms. Alento-Sneed alludes to the interactive process with the American with Disabilities Act, as Justice Nakayama pointed out, at the point at which the alternative positions were offered to Ms. Chosui, she was not disabled, and she never asked for an accommodation. And as Justice McKenna pointed out, in 378.32, there is a provision for alternative positions for employees. However, that, again, is only for employees who are deemed to be no longer capable. Finally, I will conclude, Your Honors. Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, the director and the department contend that Coke discriminated against Ms. Josui when it abandoned her and refused and failed to return her to her pre-work injury position upon her return to work, full duty and with no restrictions. And that is precisely the type of discrimination that the legislature sought to outlaw when it amended HRS Section 37832 and added just two words, discriminate against, to Section 37832. And it was therefore not clearly erroneous for the DLIR to conclude that respondent discriminated against Ms. Josui when it abandoned her by refusing and failing to return her to her pre-work injury position. For those reasons, and for any other reasons appearing in the record, we request you to reverse the memorandum opinion issued by the Intermediate Court of Appeals of Hawaii in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much to Mr. Rosenberg, to all of our attorneys. The court will take this matter under advisement, which means we won't be issuing a decision until a future time. But I would, at this time, on behalf of the court, like to thank the many people who helped make this very unique event possible. And I'd like to start by thanking our attorneys, Mr. Fujiwara, Mr. Rosenberg, and Ms. Alento-Sneed, for participating in our argument today in this very unique venue. And please, at this point, please acknowledge our attorneys for their role in the work, hard work today. First and foremost, on behalf of the court, I want to thank the students and teachers who joined us here today from seven different schools, Kauai High School, Kapa'a High School. I understand we have Kapa'a Middle Schools here, Waimea High School, Kanui Kapono Public Charter School, Kula Aupuni Ni'ihau Kahelelani Public Charter School, Island School, and also from our host institution here, the Kauai Community College business law class, who's joined us. You know, again, the students have been incredible in their level of participation and attentiveness. The future of our democracy really does rest in the hands of our young people and them understanding our Constitution, the protections it provides. So I really want to, on behalf of the court, thank our students and teachers for all their hard work leading up to and during this event today. So please join me in acknowledging all of them.